your emphasis on the importance of the historical approach interested me, because some years I've been rather interested in, curious about the past, and what appears to me increasingly is a whole catalogue of errors in the general approach to the past, including our own, a lot inherited from Marx, but other thinkers, from Thomas Hobbes onwards, that seem to be totally in conflict with what evidence we've got about the past. I remember spending a couple of years studying, amongst other things, medieval history, and the Middle Ages began with, for us, with 1066. Well, that left me with a big hole. After the departure of the Romans and the end of the Roman Empire in 407, I think it was, 600 years to 1066 is a long bloody time. What happened then? And really, you go into a bookshop or a library, and there is nothing about the so-called Dark Ages. What bits of supposition we've got appear to conflict with a lot of other ideas, a lot of information we've got. Thomas Hobbes, for example, that the life of man before organized society, he was thinking very much of his kind of society in the 1600s, the life of man was solitary, poor, miserable, and short. That's the one. And then, of course, much more recently, the American academic who talked about the tragedy of the commons, that where there were the land was held in common, it would inevitably lead to overgrazing and eventually to the death of the animals and the starvation of the people in the village. So that the common land system broke down. Now, he didn't provide any evidence of this. In fact, there is no bloody evidence for it. From what we can make out, medieval societies, medieval villages, were organized very much on a collective basis. The trouble is that even the vocabulary that we've inherited, peasants, for example, and the feudal system. Does anybody really know what the feudal system meant? It's there are various versions of it. Some sort of a trade-off, a contract between people offering protection. These are the people on horseback, the chevalier, the knights, the caballeros, and so on, to the people on the land who needed protection. But who did they need protection from? The same bloody people. They offered as much. It really was a mafia system. What we had then is, in contradistinction to what a lot of people imagine we had, including Engels, for example, the need for, as he argued, the need for a leisure class to keep art and music and so on alive. The activities of artists and musicians has always been the activities of a servant class. I mean, this is where Mozart was shocked when his employer, the Archduke of whatever it was, addressed him as du, thou, which is like addressing a bloody housemaid. And this has been the position of the leisure class, not the artists and musicians, since the year dot. And I think that, this is a vast subject, but if we start with first principles, arguing a priori, people came here as they were coming to other parts of the world, as populations migrated and moved, beginning, if you like, with the Gaelic Celts, followed by their cousins, the Brythonic Celts, but even before that, the people who built Stonehenge, we don't know much about them. We know more about them than we do about the people between as I say, the end of the Roman Empire in 1066, because work has been done on them. But these people coming into this country, coming in from mainland Europe and moving westward all the time, settling on the land, the population very, very thin, mostly covered with the land, mostly covered with trees, clearing a bit of land, usually extended family groups, social units, being careful to marry outside to prevent inbreeding, etc., etc. All the precautions that they'd inherited from their cultures over thousands of years, settling down, breeding animals, raising crops, doing a bit of hunting and fishing, and a complete system. Now, the appearance of men on horseback was the only true account of the, or the only one that is plausible that I've ever come across, is that of the Japanese film director Kurosawa and the Seven Samurai. These people appear on the hilltop and they're on horseback. Now, what are they doing on horseback? Certainly aren't they aren't plowing, or they didn't use horses to plow. They're up to no bloody good. And we've got a totally different picture of history. Here we've got a medieval mafia trying to punch off the people who were really getting on with the business of making a living. And I think that is the situation that needs to be cleared up, and it needs a whole gaggle of historians to do some serious research upon this, because we haven't got any at the moment. What material we've got is almost, is more than useless, it's grossly misleading.
I appreciate what you're saying about the function of utopianism, of having a utopian concept, because it keeps the imagination lively. But the arguments which seem to have been advanced so far as indicating that we might get from here to there are all arguments which dwell on the almost the extremities of capitalism, the horrors of capitalism, or the stupidities, like the fact that water used to be free and water is for sale. You pass garages now which advertise free air. So, I mean, and the sale of the genes, or the monopolization of the genes by American companies. I get, almost the argument seems to be that capitalism is becoming so ludicrous, you can't help but go from here to there, that utopia. But it's quite difficult to find, and nobody mentions any positive signs of the seeds of socialism here, now. And presumably, there must be some sort of factual, objective links, apart from our horror of capitalism, between here and there. But people don't talk about it. I mean, do you have any, would you point to any organizations, any activities? I mean, hospitals and schools, capitalists are all in favor of, because it keeps you well and efficient. So presumably you wouldn't say those are the seeds of socialism. But do you see any other positive seeds of socialism, any organization?
Well, I mean, you say you don't see science here now. I mean, here now is one sign, and the only time you ever will see a bloody sign.
Yes, but well, I mean, apart from this room full.
Exactly, yeah, no, but I take your point.
I think most of us have
travelled here so that we will see a sign. I don't think we've stumbled, you know, I think that's one of the main reasons we've come here, so that we will.
But I think
my answer is, no, I mean, I don't know that I see it in political organisations, but I think it is extremely deceptive, because it's a very kind of slippery thing. If you see a political organisation, you say, this is something.
Not that necessarily
is,
but, political.
No. I'm saying why I don't think it's not necessarily political is that you see political organisations which appear radical, appear positive, and then they become incorporated, they become victims very often of illusions that they possess. And that's why it's important to proceed with care there. But I mean, I do think things like hospitals and schools, and I'm not sure that I agree with you. I mean, I take your point that capital rationally needs hospitals to get people back to work. It needs schools to educate people so they can read the instructions on the machines and the computers now. I accept all of that.
That's what schools are starting.
I know why schools are starting. I take all of that. I still actually don't think. I mean, historically, it's part of what one might at one time have called a dialectic of history. It's part of something which is paradoxical in history, that education, paradoxically, always is going to militate against capitalism. It is damaging to capitalism. Educated people are bad for capitalism, because what educated people do is they become critical, they become articulate, they don't only read some books, they read other books, they don't only read some newspapers, they read others, they don't only go to one website, they set up their own website. You know, there is a critical danger. I also think this is true with health, and not just physical health. I think the broader notions of psychological health, I think people who are not neurotic, people who are not frightened, people who are not easily manipulated, people who are not guilty, are actually very dangerous for capitalism. So, you know, that's where I see the signs. But I mean, I'm not going to attempt to cite particular examples or particular events. I mean, I think, like some people here, I would see things like the fact that most young people are concerned about environmental things in general, as being more positive than negative. I see the change away from sexism, and I don't think it is just a move away from sexism, because it's a much more sophisticated agenda than that. It's actually about challenging a rather kind of brutalized gendered view of humanity, which we used to have. So it's not just some sort of recognition that women are, you know, women are allowed to become engineers. You know, that would hardly be very exciting or inspiring. What I think is much more exciting and inspiring is that not everyone has to be what the 19th century public school is called a man, fit to go in the army. You know, that one can be a human being, in fact, a better human being, and be not like that. That we have had a movement away from racism, which I actually think, and you know, there is a huge amount of racism around, but the fact that anti-racism is now the prevalent view of most people, or at least a prevalent professed view and intention of most people, is, I think, something that is positive. So we've seen trends. I think the greatest trend we saw during the course of the latter part of the 20th century has been something that is quite amorphous to describe, but extremely important, that is a breakdown of deference. What we have now is a far less deferential society. And then you have to ask, what was deference based upon? It was based upon fear of immediate superiors. It was fear of being caught, never quite knowing who's around the corner, who's listening to you, who's watching you. I think we have a less deferential society. That less deferential society is a society that the Blairs and the Hagues, in some respect, are extremely fearful about themselves now. And that's why they want to round up the hooligans, start targeting people, start putting people in their place. So I think those are the trends that I see, which I think are undoubtedly happening and are undoubtedly for the good. But I'm not sure that I could point to organisations or individual bodies, because if I do so, I'm almost bound to find someone here who's going to say to me, but that particular organisation and that body has supported capitalism in this or that way. And I think that, with the exception of something like Amnesty International, that's probably true of almost every organisation that appears to be doing something good. It is equally incorporated into the system of expecting the way that we live now to continue.
I wouldn't let Amnesty International to look.
Well, I didn't think you would.
Yes, I want to take up that general theme of change, and I also want to take up from where Dick left it. And the thing I want to put my finger on is almost as amorphous as one of the Steve's just been talking about, specific to the totally different field. And that is the effect on, what should I say, working class mentality in particular, or at least the mass mentality, of the change in the speed of change.
Yeah.
One of the things about the Genome Project, about the privatization of prisons, about the amalgamation of Black Cell and Welcome, is that for most people, the speed of change has become frightening. They are starting to see a picture that socialists have long seen it, simply because one thing follows another so rapidly that it starts to be, instead of a series of still images, a moving picture. They are now seeing what corporate capital does almost daily. And I think this is all to do with consciousness. It reminds me of an article which was in this Thursday's online Guardian section. And in fact, the particular writer mentioned the tragedy of the commons, that idea. And he said, what we have and what has been in danger of being taken away from us is a degree of freedom of operation in the internet in general. It looks like becoming corporatized. Now, what seems to be therefore the dynamic that's is that the clash between the interests of capital and the interests of society at large, not the working classes, society at large, it becoming much more clear. And someone once said to me, you'll never get socialism because people only really do anything serious when they're having something taken away from them. Well, if you're having your genes taken away from them, or your right to use a seed, your own seed that you've collected out of your garden, or the internet that you're used to using for nothing but the phone bill, and then somebody corporatizes and says, well, in the future you will have to pay for it. Well, this is, there are a number of areas there where we are having things taken off us, or people are aware of having things taken off them, which they regarded as being non-privatizable, non-profit systems, it seems to be. It's not just water and air. There is the consciousness getting very real that anything that they can make private property of, they are going to do it. And it's becoming quite a fear. And I think that this is a thing which, although it's not a class struggle as such, it is virtually, one's able to say capitalism is bad for everybody except capital itself.
I sympathise with what you're seeking to say there, and in part, there's no doubt about it. We should, I mean, to be blunt about it, we should name names apart from anything else. We should, you know, one of the things the socialist stands for is name and shame. But what the point about capital is that actually capital acts in accordance with its own laws, sometimes in ways that the capitalists themselves don't understand. So I think that the point about that is that this is the nature of a system of society, that a system of society takes on a life of its own, a life of exploitation, a life of competition, a life of buying and selling things, which very often those involved in it don't even necessarily entirely realise is going on. They don't entirely, I mean, you know, a lot of the work of actually managing capital is done by managerial sections of the working class, but most of the work. And so when it comes to it, there are certain things that are just in the interest of capital. I mean, for example, the National Health Service was in the interest of capital, albeit, you know, I made the other point that paradoxically or dialectically, it also, I think, was about other things and resulting in other things. But similarly, take trade unions. You know, there's no doubt about it, capital needed trade unions. Organised labour was ultimately something that's quite good for capital. And when you've got the rogue employer like George Ward at Brunswick, who tried to stand out against trade unions, most of his elders and betters within the capitalist class were saying, look, don't be a fool. You know, if you negotiate with these people and you deal with labour leaders who are incorporated into the system, you'll get exactly what you want. You might even get more. So there are interests which are interests of capitalism. And the fact that an individual capitalist may try to remove themselves from that, or may be morally offended by them, doesn't actually alter that. And I think that we have to humanise. We have to humanise everything, because people are human, and we only actually understand things in terms of human effects. But I think that we also have to recognise that beyond individuals, there are social forces that are uncontrollable, and capitalism is an uncontrollable social force, and it actually governs the capitalist class far more than they govern it.
I agree with most of what Steve just said, except the first bit about naming and shaming.
Oh.
I really don't see the point of naming and shaming capitalists. I mean, you've really got to extend it, you've got to name and shame everyone who supports capitalism.
Oh.
And that, if you've got to face it, it's
a long list.
Capitalism is supported by many, many more workers than it is supported by capitalists, simply because of the unequal structure.
Okay, you know, well, don't do it. I mean, don't name them and don't show. But I mean, it seems to me that if you don't do it, then what our friend is saying is also then you're missing his point, which is in fact that there are people who take responsibility for things. I mean, for example, we think about Nazism and we identify certain key figures, and we see those figures as having been instrumental in something quite awful. Now, when you consider that there are many things happening in the world at the moment that are killing that sort of number of people, one of the biggest being the starvation of millions and millions of people in an abundant planet when there's plenty of food available, I'd personally like to name those people. I'd like to know who the board of directors of these big food companies are, where they live, what they're doing, where they got their money from, what they do in the course of their day life. I'd like to know that personally. I'd like other people to know that. And I think, well, you know, I'm not encouraging other people to go along and take a shot at them, but if other people did go along and take a shot at them, I couldn't care less. You know, the problem is their problem, because they might be arrested and stuck in prison. I think it's a foolish thing to do. You're much better dealing with them in an appropriate democratic fashion. But frankly, you know, I think you want to know who these people are, you want to get at them. I'd like to know who the heads of the army are. I want to know who the heads of special. I want to read these documents that we're not allowed to see about people organising things like shoot-to-kill policies. The guy in Brazil who was killed when he was campaigning to keep the forest. I want to know who shot him. I'd like to see at some stage that, you know, if we're going to have Pinochet and we're going to have Serbian people brought to trial, I don't want to see trials. I'm not in favour of public trials and those sort of things, but I want to know. I'm in favour of knowledge. And I think you only have knowledge, you know, names are a big part of knowledge, aren't they? Otherwise you'd never know who you're talking to. So I would have thought that part of our knowledge of history is knowing who's who. And we don't hear enough about it. And I agree with him. People need to know that there are actually people who do have their finger on the button. And it's not only the nuclear button, it's a starvation button. It's a button that says, you're going to, you know, I want to know the name of people who are doing dirty deals in local councils where they're buying votes by keeping people living in squalor. I want to know the names of the people who are corrupt, and I want to know the people who are perfectly clean and legitimate but still getting away with things that are totally unacceptable. And, you know, I don't necessarily want to shame them. I use the term name and shame because it's a common tabloid thing. But you don't have to do it. It's an optional extra, and you can proceed in your enmity with the capitalist class in a benign and happy fashion and see if it scares you.
I can see why Danny wants to come back, because shame and guilt are more or less the same thing. But you wanted to say something.
I just want to say this. The re-evaluation of what utopia actually means. And I think that we should embrace it to some extent and not recoil in horror, but our reaction should be something along the lines of, well, what's wrong with utopia? Most people, when the word is used, think of utopia as something that's unattainable. They automatically link utopia as being something that can never happen. Well, what's wrong with us pointing out that socialism is not an impossible society? It's utopian in the sense that it will be so much, it's something that mankind today can achieve, which is much better than they've ever had before. And that should be what utopianism means, not some ridiculous thing way there up in the clouds, but something that's achievable. And that we should recognise that, yes, we are, in one sense, utopian, and not recoil from it.
I think that's really important. Just as anecdotally, you know, about 20 years ago, I went on the radio to do a brief talk on a programme for 5 minutes. And I was asked what I wanted to talk about. And I had a discussion with some other people, and we said, look, don't call it socialism. For various reasons, which many people here would have discussed, you know, it will put people off, it will mislead them, you've only got 5 minutes. So we called it utopia. And at the end of the 5 minutes, people had to phone up. And everyone who phoned up, the first thing they said is, well, what you're talking about is socialism. and, uh, I, I think there's no problem. You know, I think don't get hung up with words. They don't mean an awful lot. I like I like the notion of utopia. I think you've got to know what bit of it you don't like. You've got to know which bit of it you transcend, and then you go on and operate. But I have to say that when somebody calls me a utopian, I think they're pretty well on the right line. You can have a discussion. Right. Well, I mean, where was the quote from St. Augustine taken? It was taken to St. Augustine. But I'll give you the exact passage, the exact reference. If you give me a, I said I'll give you the exact reference if you give me a means of contacting me. I mean, it was obvious. It's taken from his Confessions. Oh, I see. I thought you meant which edition. I'm sorry. I could have given you that as well. No, it's not the City of God. It's from the Confessions. The point about Morris and the people who were called the obstinate refusal. Well, there are two cases in News from Nowhere that Morris dealt with this issue of what we might call antisocial behaviour. In neither of them did he march anyone to a cash machine and force them to pay 10 quid, because there weren't any cash machines and there wasn't any money. So in this sense, Morris advanced even beyond Blairism. Now, a sort of a higher stage of Blairism. Now, in terms of the two cases, one of them was a case of a man who had committed a murder. He was in love with a girl, and somebody else was also in love with this girl, as is inevitably the case in romantic novels. He kills the other guy. What happens is that he's lived for a long time away from everyone else. And he's just at this point integrating back into society, and people are sort of, some people are keeping their distance and don't want to know him. Some are getting, I think, well, I mean, I can't read you the passage, although it is a weekend for reading passages, because it's too long. But there is actually, I think, a very sensitive treatment of this worst of human crimes, a murder, in the novel, in a way that I think really shows how in a humane society that kind of action can be dealt with without taking away somebody's life and an eye for an eye, or constantly punishing them for one misdeed, as indeed even now in capitalist society we don't eternally punish people for one error of judgment. The second case is a whole chapter in News from Nowhere called The Obstinate Refusers. And these are a group of people who, although there is an agreement that people are going to be doing the harvest, the harvesting, they decide they want to do something else. And what happens is that these people are seen as a sort of rather eccentric group of people who've gone away from the others, decided to do their own thing, and got on with it. And I think, again, that's a model for what a socialist society needs to allow for. And incidentally, it's a terrific sort of example of what all of the state capitalist countries which purported to be socialism never did allow people to do. Because what happened was that the rest of the people in society said two things. They first of all said, look, we've made a decision and we want everyone as far as possible to fall in with that decision so that it gets done. That's what's needed. But secondly, they say, you've made your decision. You've got a particular view because of conscience, because of values, because of something that you need to do. Society should have let you get on with doing your thing as well. And they do, and there's a whole chapter which kind of develops how that happens. So I think the answer to your question about antisocial behaviour in News from Nowhere is that, yes, there are going to be people in any society who are not going to fall in with the others on particular issues, even quite basic issues. There are going to be people, periodically, who are going to go against the mainstream. And I would have thought what would happen in a socialist society is you simply use the power of democratic force to say, look, this is what the majority wants. But you also, as far as you conceivably can, provide resources to allow minorities to do those things that they want to do. That is also a requirement of a democracy, that you don't force people to become like the majority. You give them scope to do other things, if they've done things wrong, to get better, to recover their dignity, to become fraternal once again.
That's a horror story.
Yeah. The problem I have is that most people I talk to, I do recall snatches of what I was going to say. It's the same bloody conversation. But I actually think that, I mean, obviously, you know, there is a kind of borderline eugenics argument. I know it's not a eugenics argument, but I think the problem about all kind of issues of genetic improvement is that who's going to be doing the genetic improving to whom? I think that on your point, certainly about, I mean, I've no problem at all about the availability of anarchist literature. My problem is the paucity of what is in some of the anarchist literature. But I think that there is no doubt whatsoever that where you have naming and shaming, in any literature, whether it's in The Sun or whether it's in those things, you've got to be absolutely sure about who you're referring to and that it's the right person. One of the things you mustn't do is to attack people who you shouldn't be attacking. And far too often, when this whole kind of policy emerges, people are picked upon, very often people who are not themselves the ones who are mainly involved in doing things. So I think you've got to be pretty careful about that. But I find your genetic arguments intriguing. I'm sure there'll be scope for discussing it more in the course of the weekend.
We've had 2 hours for the last question.
On the naming and shaming, well, I'm all in favour of naming, but I'm not in favour of shaming.
Yeah.
What dogs me up about Catholic reform is that I'm so embarrassed. There are a lot of people that turn around and say that they're proud to be working class. I'm ashamed of people. I'm living in a society divided up by class. And that is a shameful thing to have human beings. We have the ability to live in another way. And I think embarrassed. I mean, Wigan actually is a lot of case actually embarrassed. Embarrassing people to actually get up and reduce capitalism. Maybe they were the alarm clock. If we can make it seem embarrassing for them, then it's like, somebody tells you flies about something, you've got a bogey, the first thing you want to do is get rid of it. You don't like being embarrassed. And I think, that might be an avenue to do it, you're embarrassed.
If you think of the process of comedy and satire, there is such enormous scope for that, and there's scope for who to do it. But the difficulty with comedy and satire is that the alternative to doing it well is not the alternative to doing it not very well. The alternative is you do it awfully and embarrassingly itself, so it has to be done really well. But I think I'm going to sort of withdraw my point about naming and shaming. I think my view is that what is important is that this is important is that there is a recognition that people are responsible for things. There is also, I think, therefore, a need for recognition that people are responsible for continuing things. There are people who are responsible for holding this society in place. But I once encountered a case, and I actually wrote a little bit about it in The Standard, and I think it sort of helped to crystallize the thinking for me. It was a court case in New York of a man and a woman, and the man was essentially, he had the woman under his power. He convinced her of all kinds of things about his own importance. And they had a child, and the man was beating up the child very, very badly, and eventually killed her. And the woman said in court, "Oh, but I am not responsible because I thought that everything this man said was right. And if he said he did something, he'd convince me there's nothing he could do that was wrong." And what the New York jury had to do was to decide whether this woman was therefore guilty, and I know that's a profoundly property-based term, but whether she was to be held responsible for killing the child, or whether she was not responsible. And it seems to me that is the position that the working class is in. I mean, on one hand, there is plenty of scope for people to say, "We didn't know, we don't know what's going on, or we have heard what's going on, but we didn't know we could do anything about it." And on the other hand, there are people who I think can reasonably be told, "You should bloody know what's going on. It's your responsibility to know." And there was an argument about this to some extent in the two wars in this party, wasn't there? Because in the First World War, the party issued a manifesto saying, "We have no enmity with the working class of the world. We're against the war." In the Second World War, there was a discussion on the Executive Committee, "Let's publish this again." And people said, "No, we can't. We have got a bloody enmity with the working class of the world. First of all," I think they quite rightly said, "we've got a particular enmity against these bloody nasty fascists who are going around murdering people as racists. But also, we've got a bit of a bloody argument with the working class. And, you know, there is a real argument there, and there's a real debate there. And if you take the view that the working class should be held responsible for not getting rid of capitalism, I think the danger of that is you slip into a kind of contempt and a kind of them and us position, which is essentially a finger-wagging position that will ultimately earn contempt, where you're saying, you stupid people haven't done this. But if you don't do that, if you don't do that at all, then I think you put yourself into a position where you actually reject the concept of responsibility, and you reject the concept that there is a choice to be made. But we know that there is a choice to be made because we're calling upon people to make that choice. And it seems to me that, you know, there is an unsettled argument there. Maybe, you know, some people say it's an airy-fairy philosophical argument. I think it's quite an important one, because it determines how you approach people. And I leave that as a question, but I think that we don't want to shame anyone. We certainly don't want to shame people who feel hopeless and helpless. I think we should certainly hold as responsible for what is going on those people who are privileged and benefiting from an exploitative system in which they are the protected exploiters. I think we certainly should be doing that. But I also have my thoughts about the extent to which we should expect those people around us not simply to have an option to become socialists or not, but to recognise that if they don't, they are in themselves complicit in a system of murder, deprivation, frustration for vast millions of people, including themselves, which they have a responsibility to do something about.
But, the Socialist Party has the World Socialism has a discussion forum. And one of the things that was discussed on this forum in the past few months was precisely this question of free will versus determinism. Can you say people are guilty? And it got quite a heated argument in the end, because one of the persons was saying there's no such thing as free will. And the other person had been a prison officer in America, because world socialist thing has got people from America, Canada, Australia, all over the world, and it really did get a heated discussion. People were insulting each other, and it led to one person resigning. In fact, the person who thought people didn't have free will, I won't make a joke about him exercising his free will and resigning. But I mean, it was the same discussion. You know, the person who'd been the prison officer said, "Well, I mean, he exactly what you'd said, that you there is some responsibility. Everybody is in some way responsible for capitalism continuing." And the other bloke said, "No, that's wrong." And besides insults about why did you choose to become a prison officer and this sort of thing. So I mean, in fact, all this is there for the record.
This should not be. That's interesting, but it should not be reduced to a crude argument. I mean, the fact that there is choice doesn't mean that there is free choice. You know, there is not totally free choice, is there?
But you see, there's a return of copying of Lenin.
Nobody told me the copy can be. You tell me, we've got 2 hours. Anyway, yeah. Copies at 11. What time are we eating?
12:30.
Okay. So, and we're coming back at 2:30, is that?
Yeah.
2 o'clock. Half back at 2:30. Well, I can't help it if the discussion is interesting. It goes on. It's our coffee break.
Hey, sorry.